Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1978, sees Nobel laureates James Buchanan, professor of economics at George Mason University, and Friedrich Hayek, PhD in economics, conclude their discussion from last week on von Hayek's controversial work, The Constitution of Liberty. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
You were saying that the two influences to be countered in your younger days in Vienna were Marxism and psychoanalysis. And I know in the Hobhouse lecture, you also spend a good deal of time talking about the baneful influence of Freud and his ideas. Perhaps you'd develop that a little bit.
Well, it was so difficult to generalize about Freud. He was undoubtedly a very intelligent and observant man. But I think his basic idea of the harmful effect of repressions just disregards that our civilization is based on repressions. And while he himself, as I point out in that lecture, became later rather alarmed by the exaggeration of these ideas by his pupils, I think he is ultimately responsible for the modern trend in education, which amounts to an attempt to completely free people from habitual restraints. After all, our whole moral world consists of restraints of this sort. And he has in that way become the, what I like to call the scientific destructions of values which are indispensable for civilization, but the function of which we do not understand, which we have observed merely because they were tradition. And that creates a new task, which should be unnecessary, to explain why these values are good.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tie it back to our other question. Given this reading of the history of the last century, and given this destruction of these moral values, which we did not really understand why we hold, how can we expect something analogous to that to be restored? Or how can we hope that it can be restored?
Well, I wish I knew. I think my present concern is to make people see the error. But that's an intellectual task. And how you can undo this effect. Well, I have an idea. The thing is, on the whole, effective via the effect on the teaching profession. And probably that generation which has been brought up during the last 30 years is a lost generation from that point of view. But I don't think it's hopeless that we might train another generation of teachers who do not hold these views, who again return to the rather traditional conception that honesty and similar things are the governing conceptions. And if you persuade the teaching profession, I think you will get a new generation brought up in quite a different view. So again, as I always come back to, the whole thing turns on the activities of those intellectuals whom I call the second-hand dealers in opinion, who determine what people think in the long run. If you can persuade them, you ultimately reach the masses of the people.
And you don't see a necessity for something like a religion or a return to religion to instill these moral principles?
Well, it depends so much what one means by religion. You might call every belief in a moral principles, which are not rationally justified, in religious belief. In that wide sense, yes, one has to be religious. Whether it really needs to be associated with a belief in supernatural, right, spiritual forces, I'm not sure. It may be. It's by no means impossible that for the great majority of people, nothing like such a belief will do. But after all, we had a great classical civilization in which religion in that sense was really very unimportant. Right. In Greece, at the height of its spirit, they had certain traditional beliefs, but they didn't take them very seriously. I don't think their morals were determined by religion.
Well, that's hopeful in any case. Let me go back now to what I was getting at a little bit, but it's related to this early period in Vienna, too. I was very pleased to hear you say earlier that you attribute a good deal of your subsequent thinking in political philosophy, political theory, to this insight that you gained in economics and knowledge, or that was expressed first in economics and knowledge. This whole notion, as you mentioned a minute ago, of the fictitious data of the economist, as you know, there has been a big upsurge within the last decade in this country of the Austrian economics group, centered around sort of subjectivist notions of economics. As you know, I got into the periphery of this in some work on cost and subjective nature of cost and so forth. And in rereading some of that literature, the central contributions were, of course, your contributions made during the period you were at London, along with several of your London colleagues. Mm-hmm. What I'd really like to ask you and have you to talk to me about would be, to what extent did this sort of notion of the subjectiveness of economics, of the subjectivity of economic choice, to what extent did that come down to you through the Austrian economist, or to what extent was that part of this economics knowledge illumination that you felt at that time?
Well, I believe I derived it directly from Menger's original work. I don't think there's much of it in the later Austrians. Now, Mises moves around it, and he's the real founder of the American School of Austrian Economics. I mean, the American School of Austrian Economics was very largely a Mises school. And he had great influence on me, but I always differed, first not consciously and now quite consciously. Mises was a rationalist utilitarian. And I am not. He trusted the intelligent insight of people pursuing their known goals and rather disregarding the traditional element, the element of surrounding rules. He wouldn't accept legal positivism completely, but it was much nearer it than I would be. He would believe that the legal system, he wouldn't believe that it was invented. He was too much a pupil of Menger for that. But he still was inclined to see it as a sort of rational construction. I don't think the evolutionary aspect, which is very strongly in Menger, was preserved in the later members of the Austrian school. Must say till I came, really. In between, there's very little of it.
Well, you mentioned the evolutionary aspect, but what I was really getting at more was the sort of subjectivist aspect, the subjective dimension of choice, which is very clear in your pieces.
I think I would almost say I have
put
the same thing in entirely different form. If the decisive factor is the knowledge and attitude of individuals, the particular question of preferences and utility right. becomes a minor element in the individual action and habits being the driving element. That we must, to me, subjectivism really becomes individualism, methodological individualism.
Well, sure, I think that's right. I agree. One man whom I have been reading a good deal of this year, and who was at the LSE at that time, more or less as an older student, I would suspect, is Shackle. Did you know him very well?
I've discovered Shackle.
Yes. I have sort of discovered him, too. He's very good.
No, I mean, I discovered him in a very literal sense. Shackle sent to me, when he was a schoolmaster in South Wales, an essay he'd written. Nobody knew him. I encouraged him to elaborate it for Economica. Then he came on a visit to London, and I've never seen a man greatly more moved, because he was speaking for the first time to a live economist, He seems to have had a great experience in his life. And I was very impressed and got him a scholarship at the London School of Economics. And we've ever since been on very friendly terms, and I followed his development with great interest. I think he's a first-class mind.
I find him to be grossly neglected amongst economists.
I entirely agree.
Because his material on choice under uncertainty and to me there's much in that that has not been digested at all by the profession.
You know, there's a very curious disagreement between two younger men of LSE who don't see eye to eye on this John Hicks and Shackle. I don't know why, but they move on parallel but completely not converging ways. And both, I think of the other that they have done rather harm.
Well, I'm interested to get that story about Shackle because I met him once. And I find him to be a fascinating man. And his book, Epistemics and Economics, is I think, a great, great book.
He's still very active thinking. I traveled with him in Spain a year ago. And we lectured together.
Let me shift a little bit, if I may, to ask you something on a slightly different topic. I remember reading a piece that you wrote in Encounter about, maybe a decade ago, in which you talked about two kinds of mind.
Oh, yes.
And maybe you could tell me a little more about that.
Oh, it's a very old idea of mine, which as I explained in the beginning of that article, I never wrote it up because it would sound so frightfully egotistic about speaking about myself, why I feel I think in a different manner. But then, of course, I found a good many instances of this in real life. The first observed instance of other people was the relation between Böhm, Bawerk, and Wieser, who were of these two types. The one, when I call the master of his subject, who was complete survey of all his subjects, who can give you a prompt answer about what is the answer of current theory to this and this problem. Robbins is another. In fact,
which one, Bombard or Wieser? Which one was which?
Bombard was a master, master of his subject. Wieser was a much more commonly thought intuitive thinker. And then later in life, I know two types who are typical masters of the subject, and who, because they have the answer for everything ready, have not done as much original work as they would have been capable. The one is Lionel Robbins, the other is Fritz Machlup. They are both, to an extent, command the present state of economics, which I could never claim to. But it's just because I don't remember what is the standard answer to a problem, I have to think it out anew, that occasionally I get an original idea.
Jacob Viner, you'd put in that first camp, too.
Oh, yes. Or I think Viner and Frank Knight are another instance of the same contrast.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
And in philosophy, Bertrand Russell and Whitehead. Bertrand Russell, typical master of his subject. Whitehead, I think, himself has described himself once as a muddlehead on the same ground that he didn't have the answers ready.
So you have to start from scratch, in other words.
No, but on a... with a sort
you start
of
rethinking the problem.
With a sort of vague background map, which is not very precise, but which helps you finding the right way, but it doesn't. The right way isn't clearly marked on it.
Yeah, I think I get the point. Let me ask you your relationships, or did you know, or how close were you to Michael Polanyi? Did you know him very well?
Yes, he was for a few years my colleague in the Committee on Social Thought in Chicago. And there was one interesting relationship. For a period of 10 years, our mind happened to move from the same problem to the same problems. Our answers were not the same, but for this period, we were always just thinking about the same problems. So very interesting discussions with his other. I liked him personally very much. I think, again, he is a somewhat neglected figure, much more Well, I think he suffered from the usual thing that if you leave your proper subject, the other people regard you as an amateur in what you're talking about. But he was, in fact, very competent. I would almost say he's the only non-economist I know who wrote a good book on economics.
Well, he was probably influenced then by you in that Logic of Liberty material.
Not much. He knew a little about my ideas. We had a meeting in Paris in 1938, I believe, organized by the philosopher Rougier, called the Colloque Walter Lippmann. It was occasioned by Lippmann's Good Society book. And that's when I first encountered Polanyi, and then we had some very interesting discussions. But some of the essays in The Logic of Liberty were already written by that time. The book appeared later. But as I say, our mind moved on parallel courses, frequently giving different answers, but asking the same questions.
Well, I asked you whether or not you thought your notions had influenced Polanyi. Let me ask a question a little more generally. Amongst prominent thinkers, who are the men you think you have influenced most?
You have influenced, yes.
Or maybe that's an embarrassing question. Maybe I shouldn't have asked that. But
it's not embarrassing. I just don't know. I would have to think. I mean, Shackle, whom I mentioned before,
I'm convinced.
I have had great influence on him. I'm discovering to my pleasure now that many of the very much younger generation, the men in their 30s, seem to be greatly influenced. But among the older generation, I mean, the people who now be in their 50s or 60s, offhand, I can't think of.
Well, I don't think there's any question of the group at London, Shackle and Ronald Coase. Surely his ideas on cost had a big...
Yes, Ronald Coase probably too. You know, had a curious influence on Hicks. You won't believe it, but I told him about indifference curves. He was a pure Marshallian before. Yeah. And I remember the conversation after a seminar when he had been talking in Marshallian terms that I drew his attention to Pareto and Edgeworth. It was the very beginning of the 30s, of course.
Well, to go back to the Austrians again, were you actually a student of Böhm Bawerk and Wieser?
No, Böhm Bawerk not. Böhm Bawerk died in 1915 when I was 16.
I see.
I happened to know him as a friend of my grandfather and a former colleague at Innsbruck and a mountaineering companion of my grandfather. But when I saw him, I had no idea what economics was because I was too young. I was a direct student of Wieser, and he originally had the greatest influence on me. I only met Mises, really, after I'd taken my degree. But I now realize, I wouldn't have known it at the time, that the decisive influence was just reading Menger's Grundsätze. Mm-hmm. And I probably derived more from not only the Grundsätze, also the Methodenbuch, not for what it says on methodology, but what it says on general sociology. I mean, this conception of the spontaneous generation of institutions is worked out more beautifully there than any other book I know.
Did you know Max Weber?
No.
Never.
Vienna was full of his influence when I came back. You see, he had taught in Vienna in the spring of 1918 when I was on the front. He had gone to Munich that summer, and I came to university absolutely full of his influence. I must say, all the girls were speaking about him because there had been hardly any boys at the university then. And my hope had been, in fact, I had a promise from my father that if I got my degree very soon, I could go for a year to Munich to study under Max Weber. But before it was possible, he died, so it never came off. But there must have been, in the atmosphere there, very great Max Weber influence. Of course, I only read his stuff when his main book came out, which must have been 1921-22. He had very close contact with Mises, incidentally, during that short period when he was in Vienna.
You think there's much lasting influence of Weber's ideas?
I doubt it. On some points, he's clearly wrong. I think the most famous thing about the Calvinist sources of capitalism, I believe he's completely wrong. And even beyond this, I rather believe that what is lasting is probably what Schütz has taken over. But I must confess to my shame that I've never studied, although he was a close friend, he was one of our Vienna circle. I've never studied Schütz's work carefully. I always intend to someday.
I know Fritz Machlup has told me about that, and I've felt the same way that I should do it, but I've never really done it. I'd like to go back a little bit to this thing that you alluded to, one time that you alluded to earlier, namely the time in the 30s and this debate on the socialist calculation between Longa and Lerner on the one hand and Dickinson and Mises and yourself and others on the other. Looking back on that debate now, it's hard for some of us to believe that people could have been quite so naive as people like Longa were to think that an economy could be computed in that sense.
But they really believed it. At least in the case of Lerner, I'm absolutely certain he was somewhat more sophisticated. Lange, I came later a little doubtful whether he was really intellectually completely honest. When he had this conversion to communism, as communism came to power and was willing to represent his communist government in the United Nations and as ambassador, and when I met him later, he had at least been corrupted by politics. I don't know how far he had already been corrupted in the 30s when he wrote these things, but he was capable of being corrupted by politics.
But you think some of people, it's hard for, at least for me, to recreate the mindset of those type of people who could...
Dickinson was an absolutely sincere and honest thinker. I have no doubt about him. He was a bit naive, that I will also concede, but he strongly believed that these things he described would be possible. Perhaps a little what the Germans call weltfremd.
I remember when you visited Charlottesville, we prevailed on you to give a very interesting short discussion of your relationships with your cousin, Wittgenstein.
Oh, yes.
I doubt if anyone else in these interviews are going to take that up, so maybe you could talk a little bit about that here.
Well, you know, I've recently published an encounter paper of my recollection with Wittgenstein. I can't say I knew him well, but of course I knew him over a much longer period than anybody in our life. My first recollection goes back to a day on furlough and leave of absence from the front, where on the railway station in Bad Ischl, which you probably know in the Salzkammer good, two young ensigns in the artillery in uniform looked at each other and said, "You're a fairly familiar face," and one of us asked the other, "Aren't you a Wittgenstein, aren't you a Hayek?" I now know that at this moment, returning to the front, he must have had the manuscript of Tractatus in his rucksack. Of course, I didn't know it at that time. But many of the mental characteristics of the man were already present as I gathered in this night journey from Bad Ischl to Innsbruck, where the occasion was his contempt for the noisy crowd of returning young officers, half drunk, a certain contempt for the world. Then I didn't see him for a long time, but I heard a lot about it because his eldest sister, was a close friend of my mother's. They were second cousins and came frequently to the house, and there were little rumors constant about this crazy young man, and she strongly defended Wittgenstein, and that's how I heard about him. But I came to know him only fairly well, much later in Cambridge. I met him there before the war. I saw him in the later part of the war when he returned. But we did really never talk philosophy. I have a strong impression of the kind of personality. We once, the last discussion I had with him was a discussion on politics. We were both returning from Vienna, but I had broken the journey in Baal and stepped into a sleeping car at midnight in Baal, and it turned out that my companion in the sleeping car was Wittgenstein. And all the first half of the following morning, we were, as soon as he had finished his detective story, we were first starting about talking about Vienna and the Russians in Vienna, and that led to talk about general philosophy and ethical problems. He was bitterly disappointed what he had seen of the Russian then. And just when it became interested, we arrived at the port for the ferry, and although he said we must continue this, he apparently regretted having gone out of himself, because on the ship he was not to be found, and I never saw him again.
Speaking of Vienna, I remember, I guess it was in the 50s, you were telling me once about a project you had to get a lot of money, as I remember it was the Ford Foundation.
Yes.
To reestablish the University of Vienna back in the...
Well, to reestablish its tradition, the idea was to create something like an Institute of Advanced Studies and create and bring all the refugees who are still active back to Vienna. I mean, people like Schrödinger and Popper and... I had a marvelous list. I think we could have made an excellent center if the thing could have been financed. But what grew out of it is a present Ford Institute in Vienna, which I devoted entirely to mathematical economics and statistics, which I don't particularly approve. I think the plan miscarried, not least because the University of Vienna did not display great enthusiasm for such a scheme.
Not quite completely, because I'm going over in March to that institute to give some lectures. But to the political scientist, you'd be interested to know, not the economist. You're quite right about the economist.
I believe, grown. I mean, when I was there once about 15 years ago for part of a term, well, it seemed to consist entirely of econometricians.
Mm-hmm. I think the economics people pretty much that way. That's right. But the political scientists are interested in public choice.
Maybe, and probably personnel has changed almost completely since. Yes.
Well, I really am straying a little bit from this whole topic of political theory, and I suppose we should try to get back on that topic somewhat. But I did want to bring in this Wittgenstein connection, because I thought that would be an interesting interlude in the conversation.
But I perhaps ought to add that I did, because I knew him, or I knew the family, read the Tractatus almost as soon as it came out, and I was familiar with thinking long before it was generally known.
Mm-hmm.
But that is really early acquaintance with his work rather than personal acquaintance with the man.
I gather in terms of your own training, it was pretty much strictly within economics. You didn't really have much, you weren't influenced a great deal by any political legal philosophy. You studied law, of course.
Yes, my main study was law, but I divided my time almost equally between psychology and economics.
Yes.
So it was these three subjects which I studied. I did get a fairly good background of the history of political ideas from one of our professors, but no particular interest. I just knew I could find my way about them. But no strong interest in political theory or anything similar.
And of course, you wrote a book in psychology, too.
Oh, yes.
I remember that book.
Well, I still believe this is one of my more important contributions to knowledge.
Yeah.
And, curious enough, the psychologists are now discovering it.
Yes, I have seen some references within the last year or, a year or two.
It's now 25 years old, and the idea is 50-odd years old.
Could you perhaps summarize that notion of the central, or could you do it in a few minutes?
Well, I think the thing which is really important about it, and which I could not do when I first conceived the idea, is to formulate the problem I try to answer rather than the answer I want to give. And that problem is what determines the difference between the different sensory qualities. And the attempt was to reduce it to a system of causal connection, associations when you might be it, that the quality of a particular sensation, the attribute of blue or whatever it is really its position in a system of potential connections leading up to actions. You could, in theory, reproduce a sort of map of how one stimulus evokes other stimuli and that further stimuli, which can, in principle, reproduce all the mental processes. I say in principle, because it's much too complicated to ever could do it. It led me, incidentally, to this distinction between an explanation of principle, an explanation of detail, or pattern prediction, as I now know it, which I really developed in my psychological work and then applied to economics.
Yes, I think that pattern prediction is a very important concept that most economists still sort of miss, it does seem to me.
I mean, it's a whole question of the theory of how far can we explain complex phenomena where we do not really have the power of precise prediction, we don't know of any laws, but our whole knowledge is the knowledge of a pattern, essentially.
I think that's very important and has been missed. And I think, again, go back to what you attributed a lot to the utilitarians. I think the utilitarian mode of thought had a lot of influence toward preventing that sort of way of going.
Well, in a way, you know, I'm becoming aware that the simplest conception of science, which I assumed was only invented by in the middle of last century, Auguste Comte and these people, goes back much further. The Newtonian example of how you could reuse all scientific knowledge to very simple laws, where one thing was a function of only one or two other magnitudes. And this conception of a single function as a prototype of a scientific explanation had probably a very profound effect from the late 18th century on scientific thinking generally.
Of course, that does have its virtues, as has been proven. But on the other hand, I think in places like economics, when dealing with human interaction in particular, I think it's had major drawbacks. One thing has concerned me, and I don't know when you attribute it, really. Maybe Hicks is partly responsible. Once the mathematicians start putting down utility functions and putting a formula in for utility functions, they have already excluded so much of the problem that, in fact, they neglect what is really going on.
Well, I quite agree, yes.
I think that I was just talking to Professor Alchin earlier, that one of the things that, in a sense, I'm influenced partly by just reading Shackle recently, there's been a tremendous neglect of the notion of sort of emergent choice, that we don't really have before us objects among which to choose. We create them in the act of choice, we recognize arbitrage really has not become central to economics like it should be, it seems to me. And that's part of this whole subjectivist, Austrian, whatever you want to call it, type of an approach to economics. But do you see any hope much for... There's been a little upsurge of the interest in this among young people in the United States, but the dominant graduate schools are still predominantly the other direction.
Certainly, but the other thing is spreading. What I'm afraid of is that people will get disappointed, because what we can know in the field of economics is so much less than people aspire to, that much of this tradition you're speaking about, my tradition, is really indicating barriers to further advance than leading to further advance. And that may well lead to disappointment again among these young people. They are more ambitious. And of course, great vogue of econometrics and all this, claim to be able to make predictions which I believe are impossible. But people don't like to accept an impossible. And of course, a certain widespread view that nothing is impossible. Hundreds of things which science has said are impossible were proved to be possible. Why shouldn't this be possible? We can't prove that it's impossible.
Yeah, this was the main thrust of your Nobel Prize lecture.
Yes.
But I wonder, I guess you're saying, and you're saying that economics is unique in this respect compared to other disciplines.
Oh, no. It's a general phenomenon of complex phenomena. You account for this already in the field of biology to a very large extent. You certainly encounter it in a theory of biological evolution, which has not made any prediction, can't possibly make any predictions. I think it's true of linguistics, which is the most similar in structure to economics as a theory. Well, I don't know whether there is another social science proper except economics and
linguistics. But I meant unique in the sense of having expectations so different from its possible accomplishment.
Oh, I see. Maybe I think that is at least particularly characteristic of economics. Yes.
So, in a sense, we're in a bigger methodological muddle.
Yes. Yes. There's no emotional disappointment in the other field when you recognize you can't find out certain things, but so many hoops are tied up with the possible control and command over economic affairs, that if a scientific study comes to the conclusion it just can't be done, people won't accept it for emotional reasons.
Every man his own economist. That's part of our problem, has been all along. I remember in that connection a very good book, I thought, written again, it ties back to the London days again and raises the name of another man who was clearly influenced by you. Is Bill Hutt,
who
wrote a book, Economists in the Public. His name ought to be mentioned in this London connection.
To that book, I've even given the title.
Oh, I see. Very good. I think, again, like Shackle, Hutt is a much neglected economist.
Yes, it's quite a different type. He's a very clear mind, but not as profound as Shackle is. I think his great advantage is clarity and simple thought, which you can't say of Shackle.
No, that's simple. That's surely true. That's surely true. What were your relationships with Frank Knight?
Personally, very good. We had several very friendly controversies. I think we were always more puzzled by each other than anything else. It was not a real meeting of minds. It was great effort, you know. We had some serious discussion. But somehow we were talking mostly at cross purposes.
Certainly on capital theory. I've always wondered why, knowing Knight very well as I did, of course later, and knowing his work and his interest, why he, in a sense, got diverted intellectually into capital theory. And for years he spent attacking the Austrians, essentially.
But he was frankly dogmatic about it. He asserted, he was absolutely certain, and had very few arguments to justify it. I always assumed it must have been some very early teaching which he had absorbed, which he had stuck, hadn't done any further thinking about it, but he felt that was one of the foundations of his economics to which he had to stick.
Well, but he always said that he came to that. He accepted the view, essentially the Austrian view, for a long time, and he somehow got converted away from it. I don't know exactly what was the...
Yes, what led him to it, at least, I don't know.
Yes, yes. But you weren't at Chicago at that time, so there were no direct...
I can't say I didn't know him when we had the controversy, but I just met him once or twice. Mm-hmm. On various places, but it's only when I came to Chicago that I really came to know him. It was very late, when his interest was much more religion than economics.
That Committee on Social Thought, which you were involved in at Chicago, that produced some interesting students who came out of that
group. Oh, yes. I mean, the mere fact that it See, it was never explicit, so defined, but it was, in effect, devoted to the study of borderline problems in social sciences. You were not limited in any way. Study of scientific method had a great influence in that crowd. And the first year I was there, of course, that was the most fascinating experience of my life. I announced a seminar on scientific method, comparative. And the people who came included Sewell Wright, the great geneticist, Enrico Fermi, the physicist, and a crowd of people of that quality. It's only happened once. We couldn't repeat this. But that first seminar I had in Chicago was one of the most interesting experiences I had, entirely on the method of science.
It seems to me that this is something that we're lacking now in, at least in American graduate schools and professional schools, is any opportunity for students to really get into these basic philosophical types of questions and issues. In the law schools, for example, legal philosophy has been waning. In politics, political philosophy is not as important as it was. There is no economic philosophy in economics departments. Nowhere do students get exposed to, I don't know, for example, where, and I'd like to get your comments on this, because I don't know where in a regular curriculum a student could get exposed to your books or my books, for example.
I know too little about American universities. My general impression is the same. I doubt, I have now from the distance a feeling that there may be something like that in UCLA. There was for a time in Chicago. See, Chicago had more interdepartmental contacts than I've encountered any other American university. And it owes it very largely to the facilities of the Quadrangle Club, where you really talked to people of all other subjects and met them. I knew no other American university where that is true. It certainly was not at the London School of Economics, which was so highly specialized in the social sciences, which made me in the end a little tired, although in my time the London School of Economics was probably the leading center still in economics. But it was narrowly specialized, it had no contact with other subjects, certainly no interesting philosophical, till Karl Popper came. And that was nearly in the last moment prevented by the positivists. It didn't succeed, but I had tried to support the attempt to get Karl Popper and persuade the Academic Council to appoint him by rushing out the publication of his The Poverty of Historicism. And that nearly destroys his chances, because he so offended all the positivists that it was too late to stop it. But one of my sociology colleagues made serious attempts to stop the appointment at the last moment.
Yes, I think I'd heard something of that story. But is it so much the necessity of having contacts with other disciplines, so much as it is within each discipline, too much concentration on formalism, at least in economics? It seemed to me that students just aren't anywhere challenged to think about the broader questions.
Well, I don't know what the cause is, but there is a great difference of people confining themselves to examination subjects and people reading about and moving in subjects which are not directly relevant to what they will be examined about. The American universities I know, with the sole exception of the Committee on Social Thought, people rather do concentrate on equipping themselves for the examination and probably for an assistantship or something like that later in a special subject, which is certainly very different from my recollection of a study where you had to do your subject, but where I spent most of your time exploring other fields, exploring related fields. I mentioned before, it was entirely possible to be not only nominally a law student, but to do all your law exams with a quite good success, and yet we mainly interest in economics and psychology.
How do you explain, to shift the subject now, how do you explain the revival, so to speak, of sort of Marxist notions in so much of Europe now, and to some extent in this country?
I don't know. I don't think on the European continent there is really a revival. There's been a continuous stream. There is in the English-speaking world. It has been for quite some time. What the cause of this is, I don't quite know. It almost looks, Solzhenitsyn who recently said that there's no person in Moscow any longer believes in Marxism. Now, that's probably the only place in the world of which that is true. And I just find it so difficult to understand what makes people believe these things. Yeah. I cannot see that it's intellectually respectable at all.
Yeah, and ideas which have been discredited, and yet it does seem to say, compared with 20 years ago, that there's more talk of Marxism now outside of the...
That's probably true.
Certainly in Japan.
Yes.
And especially in the academy, in the universities.
Mm. Yes. Oh, yes.
And so they tell me, you would know better than I, but they tell me that some German universities are dominated by Marxists.
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, I haven't encountered it. There's no noticeable influence of it at Freiburg.
Yeah.
But there is a place like Bremen, who I'm told is a completely Marxist institution.
Yes, yes.
And there's a very great influence of that curious institution at Frankfurt, the Institut für Sozialwissenschaften, where now Marcuse is the main figure, who made his reputation by combining Marxism and psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I heard a rumor at Altbach a month ago that Dahrendorf may be going there, and if so, he might straighten it out. Have you heard that?
Well, he seems to be negotiating with various German institutions. There was a suggestion of the foundation of a new Max Planck Institute for him.
Well, maybe that's what I'm thinking about. I may make the confusion.
There may well be.
Yeah.
And that, of course, confirms he's a great success at the London School of Economics. And what I rather had feared, that his nerves wouldn't stand it, had been untrue. He seemed to me a hypertension character who might break down in a moment. No sign of that at all. But what I warned them, you won't keep him long. He's not a person who will stay anywhere very long. That seems to be true. His interest is already shifting. Well, he's fully in the saddle there.
Yeah.
I mean, he's as good a director as they've ever had.
But in terms of his ideas, he seems to be coming around more and more to the position that would not be too different from your own.
He fluctuates. I don't think his development is very steady. He was at one time very enthusiastic about my Constitution of Liberty. And that was soon after it appeared. Then for a time he very definitely moved again away from that position. I think he's again coming closer.
He told me, I had lunch with him, and he told me that one of the most important events that had happened in the last decade was Proposition 13 in California, which I thought was an interesting indication.
Yeah, it's very interesting, quite unexpected to me.